Hello, I'm Cheryl Aline. This is number 0332, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is a very special edition of the Stuff File program, number 0332. Yes, I know, last week we had a special show too, when we put together the annual broadcast of the Meshach and Malik Christmas special, but this show is also rather unique. This is a best-of show that looks back at some of the guests, some of the great guests, that we've been lucky enough to get this past year. There won't be any Stuff File news in this particular edition of the show. It's just going to be snippets of past interviews. We'll also revisit a favorite idiot of the day at the end of the program as well. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0332, was my niece, Cheryl Aline, who is also a real estate agent for Sutton Realtors. She is the leader of the pack in a bumper crop of nieces and nephews. Thank you very much, Cheryl, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Anyway, let's get right to the meat of the show as we look back at some of the great interviews we've had a chance to do over the past year on the Stuff File program. Now, back on show number 0282, we spoke to Carla Valentine. She works at Bart's Pathology Museum in the UK, so she is someone who makes a living in the death industry. That can be a problem when it comes to dating. So Carla is also the founder of a dating service called Dead Meat. And that meat is spelled M-E-E-T, a service that helps to find like-minded industry types. Was it a situation where there was a frustration in meeting people that made you want to start Dead Meat?
To be honest, it wasn't for me, because I've actually been with my other half for over about 2 or 3 years now, but I actually met him on a dating site all those years ago, and it was just something that was in the back of my mind for a while. But at the same time, I also put on events and you know, things in the pathology museum, and I was trying to find speakers as well. So it's a dating site and it's a networking site as well.
Did you find that, again, not maybe for yourself, but for other people within the industry, that they had a problem meeting like-minded people?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think obviously before I became attached, I dated my fair share of undertakers and whatnot because I worked in mortuaries. And the reason there can be a difficulty in finding someone that you can share your day with is that because it's a very it's a very quiet, sort of closed off profession where you're not really supposed to talk about what you get up to day to day. So it sort of makes sense to be with someone who does the same job. And then that way, you know, you can really understand what your partner means when they say they've had a bad day, because it's very different to a bad day from somebody who works in a shop. So there's definitely a difficulty in having dates with normal partners, as I say, you know, non-death industry partners. And what I found was that a lot of couples around me were forming naturally in these kind of, you know, groups of mortician and mortician or undertaker and embalmer. So it was just an extension of that.
Now, since you started this, how many people have signed up?
There was about 8,000 or 9,000 at the last count.
Wow, that's very impressive. Were you concerned at all, or since you started this, has there been a concern that there might be some people who don't take this seriously, that poke fun at the whole concept?
I think part of the problem with jobs like this is that we're seen to maybe not have a sense of humor, or that it's inappropriate to have a sense of humor. And in a way, I don't mind this idea that people might poke fun at it, because it is supposed to be slightly tongue-in-cheek. You know, I mean, even the name is a bit of a pun. But sometimes things have got to be humorous and engaging to then give you a platform to actually talk about the important things. So, you know, on the face of it, it does seem like quite a funny idea. You know, morticians need to meet each other on a dating site. But at the same time, they also find research partners. There's a real community. And I haven't had any negative feedback at all, which I'm actually surprised about.
Dead Meat, your site, is it only within the UK or has you expanded beyond that?
Oh, it's worldwide because it's obviously the internet, you know, and it has a wide reach. And there are a lot of members from the US, but there are members from sort of France, Belgium and places like that too. So I really do, you know, encourage anybody who wants to just to go ahead and join.
So people who are there people who join Dead Meat who are not within the death profession or do you have to be?
Well, the drop-down menu on the homepage does suggest different jobs that you may be doing, for example, embalmer or funeral director. But it also says researcher and it says student. You know, and there's nothing to stop people who are interested from joining the site if they don't work in the profession. Because the reality is, I, for example, get asked a lot over the internet, how did I get into my profession? So people may want to find someone that they can see who might be able to guide them and give them some encouragement or some career advice. And as I say, you may not work in the death industry, but you may want a speaker or a research partner who does. So it's not just for people who work in the death industry.
Carla Valentine, founder of the dating site called Dead Meat. Let's leave death for a while and move on to one of my favorite living stars. Actress Yvette Nicole Brown has been on this show several times. We do love her work. The former star of Community has found a new gig on CBS's reboot of The Odd Couple. So it was an excuse to get into contact with Yvette once again. Five years as playing Shirley Bennett, what's it like now bringing a new character to life?
You know, I thought it would be harder because I'm not a trained actor. I joke all the time that I'm kind of a hack. So for me, you know, I'm always surprised that I'm able to create a new person, you know, on screen. The funniest thing about Danny is this is the first time, I think, as an actress that I've actually acting using my own voice. Because as you can see, I don't sound like Shirley. My regular voice doesn't sound like Shirley. My regular voice doesn't sound like Helen, which is the character I played on Drake and Josh. But Danny on The Odd Couple sounds like me. I use my own voice for her. I use my own hair for her. Like, I feel like Danny's my coming out party as an actress in Hollywood. For the first time, I'm being fully myself as a character. That makes sense.
Well, tell us about the character that you're playing, Danny.
Danny is Oscar Madison, who's played by the fabulous Matthew Perry. She's his assistant, and Matthew is a sports reporter. He has, like, a sports radio show, and Danny is, like, the one that keeps all the plates spinning and all the balls in the air. And she's very efficient. I would have to say that her attitude is more like Florence from The Jeffersons. Like, she's efficient and she gets the job done, but she doesn't, you know, put up with a lot of nonsense. So I love that about her. And the great thing about the show is that Oscar and Felix, as you know, are roommates. It's a remake of The Odd Couple that most people saw in the 70s, and they maybe saw the Neil Simon movie or the play. They're roommates that are mismatched. And the great thing about this incarnation is that Oscar works at home and Felix is always home as well. So all of the ensemble gets to work with both of the guys. So it's not like because I'm Oscar's assistant, I'm kind of in an office somewhere with Oscar. I'm in the house with Felix as well. So Danny has adventures with Felix. We have the fabulous Wendell Pierce, who plays Teddy, who is Oscar's sports agent, and then we have the fabulous Lindsay Sloan, who plays their downstairs neighbor. So the five of us are kind of always in the apartment, you know, putting out fires that these two guys have, you know, started between each other. So it's really been a great, great, great time, and it's a true ensemble.
So besides the voice and the look, as you've already mentioned, which one is closer to Yvette Nicole Brown, Shirley or Danny?
Oh, definitely Danny. Shirley's a mom. She's got kids. She's really, really judgmental as a Christian. Like, I'm a Christian. Like, me and Shirley share that in common, but Shirley is very judgmental and also very violent. I'm not a violent person. Where Danny is from Cleveland. She's a single woman just like me. She's from Cleveland just like me. And again, you know, she sounds like me. She's a no-nonsense person, but she's 100% herself. Like, Shirley has all these different voices she uses to manipulate people and all this stuff. And Danny just kind of straightforward. What you see is what you get. So I think I'm probably more like Danny.
Besides the better working hours in this situation, what does it feel like, the difference, the different vibe of you know, this time working in front of a studio audience as opposed to the single camera shoot you were doing before?
Well, the major difference is that, you know, I'm not with my community family. You know, I love the cast and the crew and the writers so much that, you know, it is it's bittersweet to not be there, so much so that I've visited the community set like 3 or 4 times this season already. I just pop up and go, hey, guys, what are you sitting around the table? Are we going to do the table? So it's kind of been hard for me to say goodbye and, like, kind of cut the cord. The other difference is that the audience is there. When we do community as a single-camera show, you know, you have to feel the comedic beats yourself. Like, you don't really have a clue as to if it's working or not, except for when they say cut and your castmates laugh at something you just did, or the writers, you hear the writers chuckling behind the monitors. Whereas in a multicam show, the audience tells you immediately. You say a line you've been rehearsing all week, and if it does not work, they yell cut, and all the writers come in, and there's a big, you know, huddle, and everybody tries to figure out how to make it better. So I think that multicam is maybe a more collaborative process in that everybody's in it together and fighting for the joke. Whereas when it's single cam, you kind of work it out, you and the director work it out, and, you know, you find out once the show airs, you know, when people start writing you on Twitter going, oh my God, that line you said was really funny, but that might be a month later or 2 months later when you get that feedback. So I think that the immediate feedback of multicam is the biggest difference besides, you know, gaining a new television family.
The pedigree of the show is amazing. As I mentioned to you in an online message, I mean, I was psyched to see this show because I'm a fan of Matthew Perry and Thomas Lennon. But then when I saw that you were going to be on it and Wendell Pierce, it's like, how much better can it get?
Oh, that's nice. I wouldn't put myself in with any of those people, but thank you for your very kind and possibly biased. yeah, and then we got Gary Marshall. Like, you know, it's so funny. There's been some people like, oh, they're remaking The Odd Couple. Why? And I would feel that way, too, if we didn't have Gary Marshall as an executive consultant. Like, I kind of feel like if you love the original show, the man who crafted that for you, aside from Neil Simon, is in charge of, is one of the voices behind this show as well.
Actress Yvette Nicole Brown of CBS's The Odd Couple. After a successful first season, the show will return for season 2 in the new year. Another actor from the Community universe also had a new series on CBS in 2015. Actor Charlie Kuntz went from the recurring guest part as Neil on Community to play FBI agent and tech whiz Daniel Grumitz on CSI Cyber. How does it feel to be part of what's clearly a big hit?
It feels awesome. after a few years of cutting my teeth on Community, it feels amazing to be able to go to work every day and be able to be part of CBS, which is huge, and CSI, which is huge, and just get to work with all these awesome actors, which, of course, is my favorite part. So, yeah, it's kind of mind-blowing in a lot of different ways.
What did you do in preparing for the role of Daniel?
Well, we have rely heavily on our writers, and we also have a lot of technical consultants from the FBI and a lot of private sector cybersecurity areas, I guess is the best way to put it. My character, who's been part of the FBI for about 10 years, I thought it would be, you know, most important to talk to actual FBI agents and consultants and things like that. And we learned a lot. You know, obviously, we have a little bit of ER syndrome where, you know, you can't have a full grasp of every single term that comes across your desk, but they've been a huge, huge help. And, you know, and also just to get into the mindset of somebody who works for the FBI, that's a pretty serious position with a pretty serious moral compass. So that's how I've been doing it. Hopefully it's working.
As an actor, is it different for you? Because in the past you've done guest starring roles, you've showed up on existing programs, but here you're getting a chance to literally create a character from the ground up. How much of the, for instance, Daniel's backstory is written for you, and how much do you have to kind of figure it out on your own to play off of?
You know, when we started the show, we had the one episode written. You know, just our first episode. So that's always laying the groundwork for what the character is in that moment. And then in terms of growing, you just really get to know the group. You get to know the actors, and they get to know each other, and you get to know the writers and who vibes well with who and all that kind of thing. And, you know, for me personally, because it's such a procedural and there are so many rules to follow in terms of, you know, getting the solving the crime and all of the avenues you need to go through, I was really shocked at how quickly and amazingly I got along with Shad Moss, Bawa, who plays Brody Nelson. And that, right from the very first day that we met, we started making each other laugh and having a great time. And that kind of stuff started to make it into the scripts. And the writers get to see that and who vibes well with who and who just cracks each other up. So there's definitely a lot of good Crummets and Nelson stories coming up.
I know we talked in the past when we were on the program last time. We talked about your school background. You have a bachelor's degree in theater arts from Loyola Marymount University, and I bring that up only because when you work in theater, it teaches you the rudimentary parts of acting. But now you're on this hit show. You've got to deal with things that you don't normally have to deal with as an actor. For instance, like talking to the media or live tweeting. What's that like?
Live tweeting is more stressful than the learning the lines. Live tweeting, I'm really trying to figure out the best way to do it. James told me that it's best to do it during commercials, but I just get super excited and I try to respond to everybody. And, you know, on the first pass, I miss half of the show, so I have to watch it immediately afterwards to just see what happened. I'm like looking down at my computer and picking out little random spots and trying to answer questions. And Bawa was sending me videos all the time saying like, yo, Charlie, where's Crummets? Why are you doing that to your boy? I'm just like, I'm tweeting a thousand different people. I can't talk to you right now. That's been a really fun but really strange experience to be home and watching it with everybody at the same time.
Does that response, that instant feedback literally from the fans, does that in any way, shape, or form affect how you down the road play the character?
Sure. I think it does. I think, you know, we make it for them, so it would be foolish not to listen to them. There are things that go into making a show that you can't always address or you can't always fix in the way that somebody might like them to or like us to. But I think if you start to get an overwhelming sense of people saying the same thing over and over and over again, I think it has to have an effect. And that can either be, you know, we've gotten a really great response from Crummets and Nelson. And, you know, that feels like that just lets you know that you're sort of on the right track with a relationship that people like.
A little bit of information can be a dangerous thing. In playing the role that you play, are you afraid to even turn on your computer or answer your phone nowadays?
It's definitely become an increase in my awareness of what exactly all of these things do. And that's what we try to do on the show. You know, we're not trying to scare anybody into not using their devices. That's not the intention. We have nothing to gain from that. That's certainly not the intention. But when we write a show, we sort of start with the capabilities of a device, like a phone or an iPad or a computer, and really just simply, and we have our consultants, which is really great, like, this is what these things are capable of. And then we have really amazing creative writers and, you know, producers who have done CSI for the last 16 years across multiple franchises of it. And we try to build a really entertaining story from it.
Actor Charlie Kuntz from the hit CBS series CSI Cyber. There's more to come on the Best of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, coming your way in just a moment.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
This is a special best of edition of the Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the interviews we've done over the past year. David Healy is one half of the producing team that put together film portraits of the lives and careers of many Hollywood legends. He and his partner, Joan Kramer, have told their story of dealing with Hollywood's elite in their book, In the Company of Legends. We talked to David about their initial contact with Tinseltown's elite. How did you and Joan get together in the first place to start doing documentaries about some of the Hollywood stars? I was very intrigued, for instance, by the story of just trying to get Fred Astaire on board.
Yes. Well, as so many things like this, it started by accident. We'd been thrown together on a local public television series in New York called Skyline. And Joan had booked Rudolf Nureyev, and we did a show with him. He was in town to dance with the Joffrey Ballet. And Joan said to me, you know, I booked Nureyev when I worked on the Dick Cavett show. She'd previously been a booker for the ABC late night show. And she said, he is such an admirer of Fred Astaire. He thinks Astaire is the greatest American dancer of all time. From that discussion, it's a longer story, but we decided to try and do a show about Astaire, a documentary about Astaire. But when we approached him, actually our executive producer approached him first, he basically said, go away, I don't want anything like this, please leave me alone. We wrote to him, we heard from his agent, Mr. Astaire is furious, he doesn't want you to do anything. What we discovered was he really didn't like the sort of tribute shows that were very common on TV in those days, where somebody would sit in the audience and their friends and colleagues would get on stage and shower them with compliments, and Astaire was not that sort of person. He didn't like that, to be put in that position. So we persevered. And in the end, we heard again from his agent saying, okay, because of your tenacity, Mr. Astaire agreed to give you permission to do the show. Now, what we didn't realize was that was important. We thought he was a public figure. We could do the show anyway. But it turned out that he had had control of the clips of his early films. In the 30s, his lawyer was very clever and had written into his contract that he could control the use of clips. Fortunately, we didn't know that, so in our ignorance, we were pressing on. But to get his permission was actually a huge advance, and then he cooperated and let us use a clip from one of his shows that he owned. So we moved on from there.
And that brings me back to the point of treating people with respect, because there's a very fine line when you mention about how he gave in because of your tenacity from being someone who has that kind of tenacity and going over the edge and being someone who is pushy or a bully or doesn't care about what somebody thinks. There's that fine line, isn't there?
It's a very fine line. It's a very fine line. You have to pressure without alienating. For example, again in the same show, we knew Fred said he wouldn't appear. He gave us permission to do a show, but he didn't want to be interviewed. So we thought, well, at least we can do the show. But we knew if we didn't have Fred, that we had to have Ginger. And Ginger Rogers was fed up of talking about Fred. She felt that after she made Kitty Foyle and received an Oscar for that, she was an actress in her own right. And yet everybody who interviewed her always wanted to talk about Fred. So there was a huge barrier to overcome there to persuade her to take part. And it was a case of gently pressuring her until we convinced her that we wanted to hear her side of the story. We didn't want her to talk about Fred. We said, tell us what it was like for you to do those dances, what it was like to wear those wonderful gowns, what it was like to dance on those shiny floors, what it was like in rehearsal. And she eventually said yes. And that, if you look at the show, she's actually talking about herself much more than she's talking about Fred. But the feeling of the whole show is that it's the two of them.
When you finally had the opportunity to finish this product, put it all together, air it on and air it, did it make a difference in acquiring the permission from other people when they saw the love and care you put into putting the Fred Astaire show together?
Well, one of the great things that happened was we won an Emmy for one of the Astaire project ended up being two shows, and the second of the two shows won an Emmy. So that gave us a kind of badge of approval. So on top of having done a show with one of the most respected of all Hollywood stars, Fred Astaire, and it being successful and getting tremendous reviews, the Emmy got us to the next step, so that when we were approaching other people, they knew we weren't going to do a hatchet job. They knew we were going to do a quality product, and they basically respected our ability to do a show like that.
David Healy, co-author of In the Company of Legends. And now to something completely different. Dennis Hoff is the owner of many legal brothels in the state of Nevada, including the Moonlight Bunny Ranch. We've had him on the program several times over the years, including twice in 2015. One of the times we caught up to Dennis, along with Chrissy Summers, was to talk about their establishment looking to hire testers to ensure quality control at their brothels.
It's something we've been doing for 23 years, but we've just ran out of good candidates, so now we're going public with it. We just never told anybody about it, you know. It's a secret shopper program, basically, and every restaurant has it, most hotels have it, but we always kept it to ourselves, but we ran out of good candidates, so now we're out shopping.
So what is the what are the qualifications required to be an official tester at the Moonlight Bunny Ranch?
Well, the qualifications, you obviously have to be experienced. You need to know several different positions, and I'm not just talking about missionary and girl on top and all the typical positions that everyone knows about, but the different types of positions. Somebody that's fun, somebody that's respectful. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be like the most attractive person in the world, just average Joe is fine.
Now, it's interesting that you say someone has to be experienced, because, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Dennis, I'm sure there are a lot of people who, when they go to a brothel, it's a first-time experience, not just going to a brothel, but having sex.
Absolutely. It happens every day.
So I would assume that one of the things your employees would have to do and have to know is how to, shall we say, gently inform and educate someone for the first time. So wouldn't that be something you would want to have tested too? I mean, how someone treats a first-timer, per se?
It's one of the top things on Chrissy's list is, are they compassionate? Are they knowledgeable? We want that to be a beautiful, wonderful experience. And it's a lot of business. And what we're seeing now is people in their 40s coming in, doctors, people that are very successful, a lot of these computer guys, and they're in their mid-30s to mid-40s and still virgins. And so, yes, it's extremely extraordinary. And what we'll ask our tester to do is to act like he's a virgin, just to see how that's dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Make sure the girls are respectful. They'll be testing the girls like based on their room, the cleanliness of the room, what type of music they're listening to, if the atmosphere is sexy, and based on all their overall performance and their appearance and mostly their personality.
Now, you say, Dennis, that you've had testers for a long time. It's just that you've kind of gone public with it now. Were the girls who work at the Moonlight Bunny Ranch, were they always aware that testers were potentially around?
Never until they were brought into the office and either counseled or helped or terminated. We had a situation yesterday with one of the shoppers, and the girl just basically wasn't into it. And so we bring her into the office and say, come on, we want to help you. And she told us the truth that she was a virgin 4 days ago. She lost her virginity in the brothel but didn't tell anybody, so she really didn't know much. and she wasn't very sexual. So what did we do? We got a couple of our better girls, or more experienced girls, and worked with them as big sisters to help them out.
So now that the word is out there that you're looking for testers, how far afield are your applicants coming from?
Well, we were in New York doing television shows. We did, you know, we're doing Nancy Grace. We did Maury, Good Day New York. And you interviewed, what, 6 or 8 people in New York City, right?
Mm-hmm. We interviewed a lot. And then we were just in San Francisco, and we had a few interviews there as well.
So they were lining up in the hotel. In fact, the hotel manager, who knows, we called the room and said, "Des, what's going on? You've got like 5 or 6 guys down here all saying they're going to your room."
I know. They had to get security involved, and then Dennis told them what was going on.
He thought maybe one of the girls was working out of the room or something.
But you also have more than one location, correct?
7. And
seven.
So we'll have them travel around Nevada, go to different places. Are you busy this weekend? Because I got room for one person.
I'm kind of booked up. I'm sorry. Okay. So, but what does it pay again?
$1,000 a week, U.S. And we give you a bar tab in case you want a drink, and because we're testing the bartenders at the same time as to quality and performance. And you know, we give you transportation money.
Mm-hmm.
It's the world's greatest job, Peter. It's absolutely the world's greatest job.
Dennis Hoff, along with Christy Summers from the Moonlight Bunny Ranch. As you heard, I squandered away another job opportunity. As we continue with career opportunities off the beaten path, on show number 0321, we met Odette Delacroix from Los Angeles. Her website is petiteversusplump.com, and on her site you can see video of her being squashed by women who weigh upwards of about 350 pounds.
It started from actually a custom video order. I have a custom video website where people can submit scripts for various sorts of fetishes and anything that really comes to their mind that they want to be custom and personalized. So someone said, because I'm so small, that if I worked with a really large woman, what they call in the industry a BBW, it stands for Big Beautiful Woman, that it would be really amazing to see how I could handle it.
Okay.
And so, I'm always a challenge, so I accepted that.
As you said, you're small. You're 5 foot. How much do you weigh, may I ask?
About 80 pounds.
So when somebody came up with this idea to you on the website, on the service that you offer, was there any concern on your part, just the physics of it all?
I wanted to do a little bit of practice before we actually started rolling the camera. And luckily I found a BBW model also located in LA, and she had a lot of experience working and being with women who were much smaller than her. And so she kind of guided me through it, and we created a sort of sign language that I do to tell them when I'm getting close to needing some air. Because it's mostly that the pressure from their weight isn't the hard part. The hard part is that when they're on top of you, you can't breathe. It was easier, honestly, than I thought. So I decided to go ahead with the video. I had a fun time. I thought it was going to be a one-off thing, but then I decided to sell it just for my own amusement on my website, and it sold more than anything I had ever made before.
And what kinds of things were you making before, by the way?
I was getting a lot of various fetish requests, everything from dirty talking and role play to daddy-daughter, sister stuff, amateur scenes, highly produced sex scenes, wearing diapers, eating certain kinds of food, playing in the mud, getting my feet dirty, giving foot jobs, all sorts of... I ran the gamut of all these different popular fetishes.
Now, I understand from the story that I read about this in a newspaper that you can earn something like about $180,000 doing these videos over the last little while. Is that an accurate figure?
Yes.
Wow.
Between, because I cash in on it 3 ways. Each video can make revenue in 3 different venues. I have now the petiteversusplump.com website, And that got a lot of publicity, so the traffic was there, so the sales are pretty good. And then on top of that, every time I make a custom video, I'm being paid by the fan to make it. So there's a lot extra cash to be made there. And then I also sell, I have a clips for sale store as well that I recycle the footage and put on there. So between those three, I've hardly had to do anything else. I still will do other modeling jobs for companies that I like and producers that I get along with, but this has become more or less my full-time job.
What does your family say? What do your parents say to all, about all this?
Oh, they love it because they'd rather me do something like this than gangbangs and more harder sorts of porn. I mean, they've always been supportive of me as a businesswoman. I did incredibly well in school. I had a pretty high-end job after college. So I gave them a lot of things to be proud of. And then when I decided to start this business, they were very hesitant of me and warned me that I shouldn't walk away from a job and do something crazy like this. But they knew that I liked to model, and they knew that it made me happier than anything else. So my parents live in Maine. That's almost 3,000 miles from where I live. And I told them, I was like, look, I'm going to give this a shot. Give me a year. Let's see where this business goes. And there's nothing you can do to stop me. I'm an adult, and you're over that. And I think I can make a good income doing this. Mm. So I just invested every last penny into it on a whim, and it has paid off.
Now, this has become very popular. Where do you find most of your clientele is from? You're in Los Angeles. Are there parts of the United mm-hmm. States where this is extremely popular? Are there other parts of the world where this is extremely popular? Where do most of your clientele come from?
About 50% of them are actually from Europe and Japan. So it's spread out between a lot from the UK, which a lot of that results from the press coverage I got in the UK this year. And the Japanese really love the whole squashing concept. So the sales are very good there as well. As far as in the US, it's spread out. I don't get a lot of orders from the Midwest, but every other region is about even in sales.
Odette Delacroix from Los Angeles. Her website is petiteversusplump.com. That definitely comes under different strokes for different folks. We have more of our special edition of the Stuff File program, a best of retrospective, looking at some of the interviews we've had over the past year. That's coming up in just a bit.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As we celebrate the season of giving, I'd like to share a story about how one charity's efforts to practice the Golden Rule were severely tested by an ill-advised lawsuit. A Florida soup kitchen called Love Thy Neighbor has provided meals to the homeless for years. Then one day, the charity was served with a lawsuit. The reason? A business named Love Your Neighbor claimed its potential customers might be confused if the charity continued to operate with a similar-sounding name. You heard that right. Love Your Neighbor was suing Love Thy Neighbor. The charity was forced to defend itself in federal court during months of litigation. Fortunately, the charity eventually won. Yet because of all the money it had to spend, it was anything but a heavenly ending. The founder of the charity told me that the money it had to spend on lawyers could have provided meals to 40,000 people. Let's be fair. America would be much better off if we all focused more on the Golden Rule and less on using court rules to sue each other so often. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Stand by. Transmitting sound.
You've got a busy life with a lot going on, so let the Kelly Alexander Show keep you up to date on health and lifestyle trends, education, entertainment, and current events. Our weekly one-hour show provides you with interesting and educational information while also seeing the lighter side of life. We enjoy interviewing celebrities as well as they share their stories of struggle and success. Emmy Award winner Mia Michaels of So You Think You Can Dance, Grammy winner Jody Watley, international singing sensation Taylor Dane, and astronaut Julie Payette have all graciously appeared on our show. Don't forget that we tackle important issues as well, like breast cancer awareness, bullying, and texting while driving. There's never a dull moment on the show, so please make sure to stop by and join us. www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
capture your need for sound.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Welcome back to a special year-end edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's our year-ender, the best of the Stuff File program, featuring snippets of some of the interviews we had this year. Up next, we have a familiar face, someone I've had the pleasure to talk to several times. On show number 0311, we caught up with Susan Olsen, best known as Cindy Brady from The Brady Bunch. You know, the youngest one in curls. Over the years, there have been tons of erroneous stories about the cast of that show, stories that seem to take on a life of their own. Susan helped to clear up some of those. This article that I said was in on People.com, one of the things it went on about was the hookups on the show that, for instance, it mentioned that you and Mike Lookinland hooked up at the tender age of, what, 9?
Well, 8. but it's so ridiculous that it's, I don't know. Do people have that much amnesia? Because I didn't say anything, well, except for the pot growing. I didn't say anything that wasn't already said in Barry Williams' book, Growing Up Brady. You know, and everybody had fits over it then, and but it was kind of overshadowed by the inference that Barry had dated Florence. When if you read the book, you'd find out they just went out to dinner, and Barry had a crush on her. You know, and it was completely innocent, but we were kind of stuck in a studio. We didn't have any other options. So, when you start getting interested in the opposite sex, there's nobody else around. But we all went back to regular school during our hiatus. So our options opened up then.
Yeah. If you just do a Google search, and again, these stories come up in regular fashion at regular intervals, and I'm just wondering, through the years, especially nowadays with the internet, what's the most bizarre, outlandish thing you've read about yourself?
Probably that I'm dead, or that I'm in porn. the porn thing was going on for a long time. Being dead was really when I was a kid. And there actually was a girl named Susan Olsen that died. And then when Anessa Jones, who played Buffy on Family Affair, when she OD'd, then the rumor started up that it was me. So, but I always thought that was kind of cool. It made me feel like Paul McCartney. I'm the dead Brady, yay. And if you play any of our albums backwards, you can hear Barry saying, "I bury Cindy," you know.
You laugh about it and you have fun about it. I've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of child stars, and you get basically half and half. There are those who love the entire experience and enjoy the memories and enjoy what they're doing now, and there are those who weren't too crazy about the experience. What camp do you fall into?
Probably the first one that you said, although that might be a little bit more unusual. What I find is there are those who hated it and are very angry about it, and there are those who really loved it and they still want to do it, and so they're not really happy with where they are now because they still want to be an actor. And unfortunately, one really good way of destroying your career is to be a successful child actor. And then there are those who hated it but still want to do it. And then there are those who loved it and decided they preferred other things and moved on and have happy memories. That's where I fall in.
I've also found it interesting that a lot of child actors who do not go on to stay in the business as actors become very successful on the other side of the camera. There are a lot of directors and cinematographers who gravitated to the other side of the camera when they became adults.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, I have very few regrets in life, but if I had anything to do over again, I think that when I was young, I would have gone into the cinema department, trying to be behind the scenes. I would have gone to USC and gone to the film school. But, you know, for some crazy reason, I thought my mom wanted me to be an actress, and I don't know, she kept telling me, I was a good artist, and she kept saying, oh, art is so unstable, and there's so many artists. Yeah, right. Be an actress, because that's such a stable thing to do. I think she had her logic a little off. And then I studied for quite a while before I realized I don't really like this. And this isn't really what I want to do. And yet I find myself teaching. And, you know, I had a good experience as a kid, and I feel sort of a responsibility to try to help kids who think they want to do this, you know, try to help them to have a good experience.
Well, one of the questions I usually ask former child stars, and I know you're a mom, is would you want your child to be a child actor?
No. Mostly because I think if he really had talent for it, I'd want him to wait until he was 18 so that he didn't destroy his career. So that when he was an adult and he really needed to make a living off of it, then he could. My son actually has quite a bit of acting talent, but he doesn't think it's cool. And he'd rather be a musician.
Susan Olson. You can check out her website at susanolson.net. And finally, we have another television icon who also spent a lot of time around kids. Charlotte Ray is best known for her role as Mrs. Garrett on the TV series Different Strokes and later The Facts of Life. On show number 0327, we caught up with her as she was promoting her memoir entitled The Facts of My Life.
I would just let it all hang out, my life. Let it all be out there like everybody else's life. Some of it is sweet and some of it is very, very difficult. And so there it is, my life.
You've written this, as you say, with your son, right? That would be Larry? Larry Strauss?
Yeah, Larry Strauss, as in Johann Strauss. And he's a writer. He's written wonderful books, and he's also a teacher.
What's it like writing a book like this, which basically tells your life story, with your own son? I mean, that must be, in addition to just the fact that you're writing a book with your son, must be a bonding experience with the two of you.
It was. It was, indeed. And there were a few moments that came to light where I made amends to him, you know, for things that I could have been a little more attentive to him, because I was involved with my divorce and involved with my other child, and who was challenged. Yeah, it was a very rich, powerful experience.
You had to place your child in an institution, correct?
That was something that happened at the long end of a long road of trying to do something that I thought would be better for him. But we did find a wonderful place in California.
As an actress, you have spent a lot of time working on various series with children. Was that a constant reminder to you as a not only as an actress but as a mom of what had gone on in your own life, working with kids all the time?
Well, the first one was Sesame Street. I was Molly the mail lady on Sesame Street with Oscar the Grouch and Big Bird. And the kids were so adorable and beautiful. And it was very difficult for me because they were so precocious and delightful and normal and seemingly happy. And it was hard because I was with a child who had deep challenges. And then the Facts of Life and the Different Strokes, Oh, I loved being with them. I really did. And it wasn't painful. That was not painful. By that time, we were kind of in a good situation with Andy in California with the wonderful Camarillo. It was wonderful, Camarillo State Hospital.
You were also working in a time much different to today, and by that I mean now we have Twitter and Facebook and the tabloids, and people can't seem to have a private life and do the kinds of things that the average people could do, the average person can do, without it being under the microscope of somebody online. With all that's gone on in your life, and you talk about it in your book, you talk about your son, you talk about discovering that your husband of 25 years was gay. You discuss all this in your book, yet at the time that all this was going on, the general population had no idea, right?
None. Nobody had any idea. No. No, I don't. No. No, well, I mean, I was never anyone who went in for all the PR that some people do, you know. I led a very quiet life. I was busy with the kids and with the work, you know.
You also, I mean, again, we know you from television, but you had a career that that goes back to Broadway as well. You worked the boards. Was that something that, because whenever I talk to actors, especially film and television actors, they always go on about how much they enjoyed working the stage. Are you in that category as well?
Yes, absolutely. There's nothing like the theater. Nothing like it. Wow. You know, I was the original Mammy Yoakum and Little Abner on Broadway. And I don't want to talk about all the wonderful things that I was able to do. I'm so grateful for it. But I had a long, long, wonderful life in theater. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be doing something in the spring at the Kirk Douglas Theater in L.A., a Samuel Beckett play called Endgame. I don't know. I've done so many wonderful roles, and I'm so grateful. But I love television. I love film. I love it all. I love it.
Actress Charlotte Ray. Her new memoir is entitled The Facts of My Life. You can go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0332, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You'll also find all of the links from every guest we've had in this special edition of the Stuff File program. Okay, so I did promise you a favorite idiot of the day to end things off, so let's get to it. Without further ado, it's time now for our Retro Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
This year's Idiot of the Day grand prize winner for 2015 could also be the winner for the Darwin Award year-ender if we were to have that award, so you already know how this story ends. It comes from show number 0307, and it still makes me laugh in a macabre kind of way reading it again. A gang member died because he tried to gold-plate his own testicles to celebrate his 17th birthday. Nazario Conchuza Gonzalez was part of the infamous MS-13 crime family and tried to gold-plate the twins because he had recently been nicknamed Pelotas de Oro, which means golden testicles. So he stole a professional automotive gold plater from a local garage, having already painted his genitals with a lead-based paint, and attempted the plating. He was just 17, as I said, and in reports it suggests he was a big fan of Austin Powers' Gold Member, where, if you remember, Gold Member had a golden penis. No joke, his own stupidity at thinking this was feasible caused his death. That and the lead poisoning. Now, you have to agree that this story takes idiot to a whole new level because why, oh why, would anybody think that having gold-plated nuts would be a good idea in the first place? Well, one reason, and one reason only, they're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this best of edition of the Stuff File program, number 0332. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0332. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.